Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop for caregivers coping with a loved one's metastatic prostate cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 697 participants on the call, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions of this country, and we also have international participants from Canada, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom, so you really come from all over the world. And it's a credit to you that you're spending the next hour with us. Today's program has been made possible by educational grants from Astellas and Medivation, Genomic Health, Inc., Janssen Services, LLC, and the Safeway Foundation. I really want to thank them for their corporate collaboration and partnership in making today's program possible. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is information about all the different collaborating organizations, about our speakers and the topics we'll be covering. And there also is information about just the topic that we're addressing today. There is also an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, you are the really best people to tell us the programs we should be offering. You have a very good sense of the topics that are important to you. Indeed, today's topic and this whole three-part series on prostate cancer has really been, the topics have really been driven by your recommendations. So tell us what you'd like us to offer, and we'll try very hard to implement your suggestions. Now, we have wonderful speakers today on our program, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. And Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and she's professor of medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin is going to address an understanding of metastatic prostate cancer, current therapies, new treatment approaches, and clinical trials, and communicating with the healthcare team and determining when you need help. And it's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's always very exciting for me to try to convey the enthusiasm that we as doctors have toward the treatment of prostate cancer that has failed conventional therapies. One of the things we're seeing now is that patients are living longer with prostate cancer. It's not uncommon to see people who are ranging from their diagnosis and have disease, and that disease has been under excellent control for years. And part and parcel to the fact that people continue to do well and that we have so many new treatments for them is the fact that we're seeing more and more family members become involved in the patient's care. In fact, I sometimes feel that I'm treating the family along with the patients, because now patients' families, whether it's the caretaker or the son, the daughter, any sort of relative or friend, they really are becoming very interested. There's new information out there, and I think, if anything, we are providing a heck of a lot more support for those people who are really involved as the sort of the lean-tos, if you will, to the patient. So I say very encouragingly that we are so happy to have so many people interested in really participating in the care of the patient. Now, I've often spoken about the fact that we're a multidisciplinary group, that when we treat patients, we not only worry about their psychological well-being, but also from a social standpoint, you know, what can we do to make it better for the patient? How do we take care of pain? How do we take care of issues at the home level? And that's really part of a multidisciplinary group. And we actually have today Mr. William Gorin, who will help address that in terms of caregiving. And also, we're very pleased to have Dr. Kenneth Cuppert, who is a colleague of mine who is an expert in managing pain and really has assisted patients in really having a markedly improved quality of life. Now, when we talk about metastatic prostate cancer, we're talking about sometimes cancer that can be seen on the scan that has escaped the confines of the prostate and has gone to bone or lymph node or other structures. And in many cases, for patients who have failed conventional hormonal therapy, which is the mainstay of treatment for metastatic disease, sometimes we actually have patients who have failed hormones but don't have any evidence that their disease has spread based on the scans or imaging like bone or CAT scan. And instead, we know that these patients, based on the rapidity of the PSA in its rise, probably have what we call microscopic disease, and it may be months, weeks, years before we start to see it. That being said, we still are on a quest to control the PSA and also control disease, even if we can't see it. So, as I often tell patients, controlling the PSA is one thing, but one also has to be aware that just because you're controlling a number, there is always the possibility that that cancer is still in a dynamic state, that it continues to grow, however slow or quickly depending on the case, and that you really need to take it into consideration by really keeping up with imaging and other parameters to help you know whether or not the cancer is under better control. We're very fortunate in that there are many approaches toward treating metastatic prostate cancer. More recently, what has come to the forefront and is still awaiting validation is looking at molecular profiling, how to really identify any particular genetic alterations that may mean that your cancer could be better treated with a different drug compared with others. In addition, there are new imaging modalities that are out there, some are still in their infancy, that may help us determine what is active versus inactive due to cancer. As many as you know, many of you know, bone scans are really not specific for cancer per se. It's what we call bone turnover. And sometimes arthritis, infection, disc problems that many men have over the course of the years, or even a loss of height in the discs or the vertebrae can actually obscure areas of disease, and so we sometimes need other imaging modalities to give us a better anatomic evaluation of that site. There are many new drugs that are out there. I guess everybody's probably heard that abiraterone or Zytiga, as well as enzalutamide or Xtandi, are two of the newer oral hormonal compounds that have been FDA approved within the last year. These have been very helpful in managing patients, both those who have already had chemotherapy, which is often a standard if hormones no longer work, but have actually been moved into the earlier treatment setting, meaning before chemotherapy. And so this offers us a larger range of treatments before patients have to go on to chemotherapy. I want to underscore one point, and that is people assume chemotherapy is really the big C word. It's bad. It reminds them of Aunt Tilly going bald. And there's nothing farther from the truth. People actually go to work. Indications for using chemotherapy have been people whose PSAs are doubling or tripling very rapidly, or they're not feeling well, they're feeling sickly, or if they have so much disease that they would need to radiate their entire spinal column, well, chemotherapy will spare the bone marrow, it will improve the quality of life and even pain control. But the benefit of some of these newer oral drugs is that one does not have to wait for chemotherapy. They actually can provide fairly rapid treatment response. Not in all cases, but I would say in the majority. In addition to these new drugs, there are other agents that are out there. For example, many of you have heard of Provenge or Cipolucel T, which is a cellular product immunotherapy made of the patient's own immune cells. While this has not been shown to dramatically change the response of the cancer, nevertheless, it has been helpful in certain cases, and it offers another unusual approach other than chemotherapy or hormonal agents. For patients who have metastatic disease where pain may be an issue and it may be that other routine medications may not be helpful, a new drug has just been recently approved called alpharadin or radium-223. The other name for it is Xofigo, X-O-F-I-G-O. And this drug has been shown in a very large phase 3 trial in Europe and subsequently in studies in the United States to actually give significant control of the disease as well as improve pain. Now, again, does it work for every patient? No, but in the majority of patients, it definitely is advantageous. There are other drugs that are out there now as part of investigational trials. Many of you may have heard of XL-184 or cabozantinib, which is a drug that is against a particular signaling pathway in the cancer. And this, again, is another approach that we're using. So in summary, we're looking at hormones, newer ones. We're looking at immune therapies. We are looking at targeted drugs that affect pathways. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot more coming down the line, which is very important. Now, one thing I do want to say in closing is that taking care of patients with prostate cancer is a multidisciplinary approach. It means that as physicians, as medical oncologists, for example, we really need to maintain relations with doctors on the outside. So many of our patients have other medical problems that could be anywhere from osteoporosis, for which certain drugs like Xgeva or Zometa could be used. But in general, they have hypertension, diabetes, there are other issues, that cardiac issues that may be a problem. And it's extremely important for us to really maintain an open dialogue with the doctors so that they know that if they have to manage a patient who has cancer, that the medical problems can be done in a very safe fashion. I think the most important thing for any patient to do is to make their treating oncologist or radiation oncologist or pain doctor aware that there are other doctors in the loop so that we all at least can communicate in terms of providing excellent care for the patient. So with that introduction, I'll stop and turn it back to you, Carolyn. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Slovin, for just a wonderfully comprehensive presentation on metastatic prostate cancer. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Bill Gorin. He's Director of Clinical Services at Cancer Care and an oncology social worker. And Bill is going to address the role of the caregiver, challenges and rewards of caregiving, a guide to talking with your loved one living with metastatic prostate cancer, practical financial, social, and emotional concerns and resources for assistance, and long-distance caregiving, and tips around self-care for the caregiver. So Mr. Gorin is going to really address many of the issues that many of you as caregivers face on a day-to-day basis. I'm going to turn the program now over to my colleague, Bill.
Thank you, Carolyn. At Cancer Care, we do acknowledge that cancer is oftentimes a family disease, and I would say that prostate cancer in many cases could be considered a couple's disease, a disease for the couple, being the person with cancer and the caregiver. Caregiving for most caregivers is a complex labor of love, and it directly affects life, love, affects the present and the future. And for most caregivers, providing the variable types of caregiving, whether it is a long distance or more local, informal, part-time assistance to more timely emotional medical activities of daily care are unconditional parts of being in a committed relationship. In general, caregiving can provide the couple, whether it is a couple as a committed couple or a couple as friends, with the opportunities to strengthen and deepen an already established commitment. It can be an opportunity to provide as well as receive love, gratitude, and resolution. Many caregivers in research state that they appreciate life more as a result of their caregiving experience. And often many caregivers state they have an overall sense of accomplishment and confidence. But on the other side of the caregiving experience coin, there are other aspects of caregiving to address. All cancer diagnoses come with a common shared components for both the person with the cancer and the caregiver. These common components, fear of the unknown, concerns for the present and the future, unexpected and unwanted changes in quality of life and in life balance and life direction, an emotional roller coaster, concrete and financial considerations. But as well, cancers have specific components that have that are specific to the type and certainly to the stage of cancer. And with prostate cancer, there are multifaceted layers of reactions and responses. Prostate cancer is comparatively the primary male-identified cancer where the emotional and psychological factors of the illness and treatment side effects are justifiably as decisively important as are the clinical factors, if not more. And unlike most other cancers, prostate cancer speaks to the heart of male identity and image, so that the discussions of treatment side effects, loss of lower loss of libido, impotence, incontinence, all either temporary or permanent, or absolute components to be carefully and clearly reviewed by the medical team and necessitate ongoing exploration with the patient and when appropriate, with the caregiver or the loved ones. The variable side effects places a man and his caregiver or his partner immediately in the midst of quality of life issues, rendering the potential for in-depth and heartfelt discussions focused on the makeup of the relationship, especially intimacy and love. There will be an impact on the person with cancer and the relationship with the caregiver once a diagnosis is made and a change in the quality of life for that caregiver. However, the toll can be mitigated to a degree with support for the individual patient and with support for the caregiver. This means an emphasis on active and substantive communication with each other. A man's sense of self is related to how well he will be able to communicate and share his concerns with his partner or his caregiver. And at times, generating that conversation may be up to the caregiver, who can be the catalyst for that type of conversation. Caregivers, when accepting that role, have the opportunity to mitigate the potential for greater stress on the relationship by opening up the channels to discuss the many decisions and life changes that accompany a prostate cancer diagnosis. Some suggestions for the caregiver are to talk about the stressors of being a caregiver with the person with cancer. Talk about the choices that are of concern, that are difficult, and that possibly could be made together. The hopeful goal will be that the partners, the caregiver, and the person with cancer will explore and offer mutually satisfying expressions of concern, of care, possibly of love. But for the caregiver, there's a whole variety and myriad of responses that are often shared and very, very identifiable and very mutual. Stress, confusion, anger, shame, anxiety, mood swings, loss of energy, too much or too little sleep, depression, loss of interest in normal, enjoyable activities, hypervigilance, which is sort of a strong, maybe overreaction to normal daily stimuli, sadness, feeling overwhelmed, feeling alone and lonely, and sometimes physical manifestations such as headaches or body pains or just feeling sick. These are common themes that caregivers often report to social workers, to their doctors, to each other. Remember, the consequences of caregiving is that you are, as a caregiver, you're grieving. You're grieving what the person with the cancer is going through, but you're also grieving what it is that you're going through and the changes in the quality of life that have ensued as a result of the cancer. So as with any cancer diagnosis, life is altered. Identity and definition are now permanently shifted for the person with cancer and for the caregiver. A caregiver to a man with cancer may experience similar levels of and amounts of stress, although the nature of that stress may be different than those felt by the patient. So essential to learning to cope and live with cancer for the patient and the caregiver is communication. Caregivers face necessary tasks of examining their individual reactions to the diagnosis and treatments and searching for opportunities to share those reactions. For some, this is not easy, it's not comfortable, it's not historically what they have done. But caregivers need support. Caregivers need caregiving, and we call this secondary caregiving. Whether you're a local caregiver or a long-distance caregiver, which has its own specific stresses, support is essential and often consists of both informal and formal support. If you are a person with cancer, you may be the one to suggest to the caregiver to seek out support. When the caregiver is stressed, the caregiving is strained and the relationship is taxed. As a caregiver, find out about caregiving resources. Talk to your doctor. Talk to your therapist so they can monitor both your physical health and your emotional well-being. learn about external support systems, individual or couples counseling, caregiving, group counseling, caregiving, peer support organizations. These outlets can provide the caregiver with information to improve coping strategies, as well as provide communication skills and tools, all necessary to build a framework that is about learning to live life as a caregiver. Ask for and accept help. Don't feel guilty about not being the perfect caregiver. No one took a course in caregiving until life, like, thrust them into that position. You sort of learn caregiving as you do caregiving. Remember to set realistic goals and prioritize stressors and tasks into smaller stressors and tasks, and delegate. Identify what you can change and what you cannot change in the course of your caregiving. Stay in touch with your supportive families and friends. Schedule breaks. Try to have fun, however brief or small. And these sound obvious, but remember to eat, take care of your health, and try to get sufficient sleep. And as I said before, for some this comes naturally, and for others this really takes an adjustment and consciousness and awareness. And to close, cancer care oncology social workers are expert in working with caregivers who are coping with and learning to deal with a loved one who has cancer. Caregivers counseling service, whether that's in person or on the phone or online, can provide the emotional support caregivers need to begin this courageous journey of learning to live life as a caregiver. At Cancer Care, we have both online and phone support, caregiving support groups for our national audience, and for local audience, we have individual and group counseling for our caregiving clients. So please contact our Cancer Care website, which is www.cancercare.org, and you can also call us at our toll-free number, 800-813-4673. And with that, I'll turn this back over to our moderator, Dr. Carolyn Messner. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Gorin. Bill, that was a wonderful presentation and very informative for caregivers. A lot of content there, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Kenneth Kubert, and Dr. Kubert is an anesthesiologist in the pain service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Kubert is going to address managing pain, discomfort, and treatment side effects, as well as quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Kubert.
Thank you very much for having me. I think over the last 15 years that I've been at Sloan Kettering, there have been a lot of exciting and new medications to try to control pain, and also new techniques to try to control pain as well. I think that also the attitude towards controlling pain has been much more aggressive as a primary symptom. And I always tell patients that we need to control the pain because you need to go get your treatments. You need to do the things you need to do your activities of daily living so you can get better and fight the cancer. There are a lot of reasons why people do not want to take medications to try to help the pain, and some of the things that I hear all the time is that I don't want to get addicted to the medications. And I think it's really important to understand that although when you take opioids, you will get physically dependent on them, meaning that if you stop them abruptly, you will have some symptoms of withdrawal, that psychological addiction is very different than physical dependence. And psychological addiction occurs when people take it to get high, and we're not doing that for cancer pain. And people who have cancer pain and chronic cancer pain do not get psychologically addicted to these medications. One of the other things that I often hear is that people say, I don't want to take the pain medications now because they're afraid that they won't work later. And that that goes to the tolerance of these medications. And you do develop some tolerance to the medications, but that tolerance development is extremely, extremely slow, especially in chronic cancer patients. And it happens extremely slowly and may not happen at all. And if it does happen, there are many ways that we can deal with that as far as switching the medications and adding other medications or switching the way we manage the pain. So those kind of fears should not come into play when we're trying to eradicate pain. The other things that sometimes we also hear from patients that they feel that they're afraid that they are going to be too out of it or not be themselves. And that's why it's very important to work with your healthcare provider to find the right balance of medication to take so it will control your pain but not make you too sleepy or make you not be able to do your activities of daily living. There are so many different formulations of medicines out there and different techniques to block and also eradicate pain that there should be able to find some kind of formula for you that will do this without making you not be able to live the life that you want to live. So when we talk about pain, what you want to try to do when someone comes first to talk about their pain and try to figure out where the pain is, because it's extremely important to know where the pain is coming from. And we usually talk about pain in three different forms. The first form is a somatic type pain, and an example of that would be metastatic disease to, say, the rib. And that kind of pain usually feels very focal or very localized and is usually very achy. The other type of pain that we usually see is a visceral pain, and that type of pain is when the disease goes to an organ. And if the disease goes to, say, the liver might stretch, and you might feel pain in your right upper quadrant. That type of pain is kind of vague and can be referred and can be referred to the shoulder or to the back and is not as focal or pinpoint as a somatic type pain. The other type of pain, which is very different than the other two, is neuropathic type pain. And neuropathic type pain is when the cancer invades the nerves. And this type of pain is usually felt as a burning or a lancinating type pain. It's a pain that you don't really experience that a normal pain would be. It could be very sensitive to touch, and it could even itch. There are different medications for different kinds of pain, and you have to kind of attack pain in different ways to try to control it the best way you can. The first type of medicines that we use are the NSAIDs, and you can get a lot of these over the counter, the Motrins, the ibuprofens, and the Aleves. You have to be real careful when you get things over the counter because many people believe that because it's over the counter, it can't be harmful. Well, if you take Aleve, which is half the dose of naproxen, and you take four or five of them at a time, it can be very detrimental to you. So you have to be real careful about the dosages and the amounts you're taking of over-the-counter NSAIDs. You also have to be careful with NSAIDs with your stomach because it can cause gastritis and ulcers as well. And also people have kidney disease. And a lot of cancer patients are on Coumadin and Lovenox and blood thinners, and those two medications cannot be together as well. Also, some of the chemotherapies use steroids, and you cannot mix NSAIDs with steroids as well. Also, I think the thing to be aware of is Tylenol and to limit its usage as well, because Tylenol can mask fevers as well as cause liver damage if you use too much of it. And you think because it's over the counter, you can use just as much as you want, but usually we try to limit it to about 2 grams a day. When we talk about the opioids, we always talk about using the opioids in a more around-the-clock basis. If you find that you need to take an opioid or a narcotic pretty frequently, then you really should be taking it on a more long-acting basis. To take it, short-acting medications is not as efficacious as taking something that's already established as a level inside the blood. So we use various pills that are time-release pills. We use patches that are worn transdermally, which kind of provide long-acting relief. And if you think about it, if you had diabetes or you had hypertension, you wouldn't take medication just as you needed it when you measure your blood pressure or when you measure your sugars. You would take the medications on an everyday type usage, and that's what these long-acting opioids are for. And there are a lot of them, and there are some new ones as well that have come out as well that provide different advantages over one than the other. When you hear about medications, we usually think of morphine, and we think of morphine as being a very strong opioid. And in fact, morphine depends on the dosage of the morphine or whether or not it's as strong as anything else. Vicodin was typically given out by surgeons for post-op pain because they didn't have to write it on a triplicate, and it was a Schedule III drug. But if you take enough Vicodin, it can be stronger than a morphine dose. So what we usually do is give a long-acting opioid, and there are different formulations of these. There is a long-acting morphine, which comes as an MS content, which you usually give three times a day, Acadian, which is given twice a day and can be sprinkled on some applesauce if you have difficulty swallowing, and Avinza, which is a once-a-day morphine preparation. Oxycodone derivatives come as OxyContin. There is an oxymorphone derivative, which comes as a long-acting Opana, and there's the fentanyl patch, which you can change every 3 days, and it can be absorbed transdermally, and that takes the taking the need for taking pills. There's also a medication that we use called methadone, and we use methadone a lot for chronic cancer pain, and people think methadone is for people coming off of drugs and people who are addicted to drugs. And methadone is actually a very good, potent painkiller with a very long half-life. And they use the long half-life for people coming off of medications and coming off of drugs. But in this case, we use methadone for pain. And it has effects that will help both neuropathic pain as well as somatic and visceral type pain as well. So it's really important to work with your healthcare provider, your oncologist, pain specialist, to come up with a regimen of a long-acting drug that will provide you with a level of medication throughout the day so you're not going up and down in your blood levels. You don't want to peak and plateau and then dip down below the level of pain relief. If you just take short-acting drug, you might be having more side effects than you are pain relief because you get that initial pain relief and then the medication goes away. But we use the shorter-acting drugs, the immediate-release drugs, to help with breakthrough pain. And breakthrough pain does occur with cancer pain. You can be taking a long-acting opioid and have episodes of intermittent pain. And that's what we use the short-acting drug for. But it should be only used for those moments where the pain breaks through the normal cycle. And it could happen when you're more active, when you move a certain way, when you have to go for a certain test or you have to lay on a certain table, or just when your activities of daily living increase. But it should be not as often as three or four times a day, because if that happens, then you're usually not taking enough long-acting drug as well. And these drugs do have side effects, and we see nausea, fatigue, and constipation as a side effect. But it's really important to note that people get tolerant to those side effects. The only one that they do not ever get tolerant to is the constipation effects. The fentanyl patch might be a little better for the constipation, but overall, all these medications do cause constipation. So you have to get on a constipation regimen when you're taking these medications and stay on it every day and make sure that you have a bowel movement at least every 2 to 3 days. So just like pain, where you don't want to get behind the pain, you don't want to get behind the constipation as well. So we generally recommend a bowel regimen whenever we start these opioid medications. The opioids and the NSAIDs work very well for somatic type pain. Again, a metastatic disease to the bone. Sometimes the opioids do not work as well for neuropathic pain or pain coming from a nerve. Sometimes they do work very well, and sometimes you have to give a little bit of a higher dose for them to work. But there are also other drugs that we use just basically for nerve pain. And a lot of these drugs have been recently advertised on TV, and those being the Lyrica and the Cymbalta. And the Lyrica is a drug that they're marketing now for fibromyalgia, but it's really a good drug for different types of nerve pain. And what it does is it kind of controls the firing of the nerves. There's a drug called Neurontin or gabapentin that we've been using for years, which is kind of the old Lyrica. Neurontin and Lyrica are very similar in their effects on the body, and the Neurontin tends to bind to the certain receptors less than so than the Lyrica. So the Lyrica is kind of like the new Neurontin. The Lyrica has gotten a lot of press, and you see it on TV all the time, and they have a whole list of side effects from it. What we've seen in practice is that it can cause people to be dizzy. It can cause some swelling in the legs, and it can cause waking, and sometimes tremors as well. But don't let the commercials scare you. It's a very safe drug. But it's not for everybody, and sometimes it does make people dizzy or nauseous, and it may not be the right drug for you. But it does help with neuropathic pain and also pain such as neuropathy and pain from other things that happen when you have neuropathic-type pain. The other drug that we use a fair amount are some antidepressants. And again, Cymbalta has been on the TV for fibromyalgia as well. And Cymbalta acts in a slightly different way, but also controls neuropathic pain. So there are a lot of drugs. There are a lot of drugs that work for different things. And attacking specific pain that you have can be used. Yeah, a combination of these things. You can use a long-acting opioid with a short-acting opioid, and you can use a neuropathic agent as well. And you can use an NSAID as well. And attacking it in different ways is sometimes the way to go. And I think that there's no reason why anybody should be in pain. And somebody, when you have pain from cancer, you should seek out care and be aggressive in trying to treat that pain. There are also other ways we control pain, and that's sometimes by blocking specific nerves. If there's a metastatic disease to the rib, we'll sometimes block that particular nerve and actually freeze it or heat it or kill it, so that doesn't emit the pain response, and that can last for months as well. And we use that in our armamentarium as well as with these medications. Sometimes people can't tolerate oral medications. We'll give IV pain medications. Also, sometimes when IV pain medications aren't the answer, we'll give the medicines in a different way through the spinal fluid, and give the medicine what we call intrathecally. This comes in the form of an intrathecal pump and gives the medicine through the spinal area. It has advantages of not giving as much, but having the same effect. And then we can lower the side effect profile as well. So there are a lot of different ways to try to control pain, and I think it's very important to be aggressive in trying to find out what works best for you. And with that, I'll throw it back to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Covert, for just an excellent presentation and very comprehensive in terms of managing pain and discomfort, really very extraordinary, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Francois Ide, and Dr. Ide is a clinical associate professor of urology, Weill Cornell Medical College of Cornell University, director of advanced urological care. And Dr. Ide is going to address coping with incontinence and suggestions for maintaining and enhancing intimacy and sexuality. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Ide.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, with a very nice introduction. Let me start by saying that incontinence, unfortunately, does occur in a relatively small portion of patients after prostate cancer treatment, But the good news is that we can fix most type of incontinence, or we can help patients who suffer from incontinence. Incontinence of urine can have a very profound effect on your daily life. It can cause you to become homebound and constrained. It can cause depression and be very embarrassing. Patients often do their best by adapting to their situation by either restricting fluid intake, planning their daily activities according to the availability of a nearby bathroom, and having to carry pads or diapers with them. Patients with dealing with incontinence will also have to deal with very high cost of diapers and appliances. It's useful to classify incontinence. One way that we look at incontinence in urology is to break it down into three major types. The first is what we call urge incontinence, and that's leakage associated with an overwhelming need to urinate, also known as overactive bladder. You probably have seen a lot of commercials on television addressing this type of incontinence. Stress incontinence is leakage during physical activity that increases intra-abdominal pressure, which then pushes the bladder on the bladder, and then urine will leak. You see this type of incontinence in when one lifts, exercises, sneezes, coughing, or when moving from a sitting position to a standing position. This is a type of incontinence that is seen after prostate cancer surgery, for example. And then, of course, you have mixed incontinence in patients who have a little bit of both, and then those patients have to be dealt in a slightly different fashion. I'd like to move on to the way we manage these types of incontinence. Overactive bladder, as you may have guessed, is best treated with medications. And then there's a whole host of medications available now. Some of the most common ones are Detrol long-acting, Ditropan XL, Vesicare, Enablex, and Centura. Now, a lot of these medications, unfortunately, also have side effects such as dry mouth and constipation. And so there are ways to around that, and there's a medication called Gelnique, which is a gel which will avoid the dry mouth. And then there's a new drug also called Mirbetric, which is available when people have side effects from other medications. Regarding stress urinary incontinence, the treatment of this type of incontinence is completely different. There are ways of coping with this type of incontinence, such as absorbent pads, diapers. There are some medications that we use which are what we refer to as off-label. In other words, they're used for other causes, such as Sudafed, for example, can strengthen the sphincters, but also antidepressant and antihistamine medications can cause the bladder to store urine more effectively and make it so that the patient will leak less. And then there are devices, behavioral modification, biofeedback works in the beginning after prostate cancer surgery. If the patient doesn't improve in about a year to a year and a half after the prostate cancer surgery, biofeedback is not very useful. We've also tried injectables, injecting bulking agents around the urethra and trying to give a little bit of resistance to urinary outflow and try to mimic a prostate in patients who've had their prostate removed, and that unfortunately does not work very well. And then there are non-medical and non-surgical devices such as clamps. These are easy to use. You may be familiar with the Cunningham clamp, and then there is a C3 clamp. These are little devices that pinch the penis and prevent the urine from leaking. The disadvantage is they're bulky. They can cause pressure on the flesh of the penis, and generally they're not they're difficult to deal with in times of intimacy, and therefore they can be cumbersome. Catheters is also something to be aware of, and in some patients, unfortunately, we have to use catheters, but they can be very well tolerated. They're attached to a bag. There's a slight increase in infections with catheters. And then finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about the slings. In some patients, there is a very mild incontinence. There's a type of incontinence that we see after prostate cancer surgery, which is called orgasmuria, incontinence of urine that occurs during sexual activity and during orgasm. And this can be very mild incontinence. And in some instances, it can be a little bit annoying during sexual intimacy. And we've performed slings. A sling is a mesh type of material that is placed the base of the urethra behind in an area called the perineum. A small incision is made, and this procedure takes about 10 to 15 minutes to do once the urethra is exposed, and can provide some relief of orgasmuria, which can be a little bit of a turnoff during sexual activity. Now, there are many types of slings, and several companies now utilizing slings. There's been an issue with mesh recently, so you need to consult with your doctors before proceeding with such a device. And then finally, there is the artificial urinary sphincter. It's a small hydraulic device, which is something we refer to as the gold standard. That is reserved for severe incontinence that requires several pads a day. This usually is performed in an operating room. Patients can go home the same day. However, it takes about 60 minutes to 90 minutes to do. 92% of patients who were asked whether the sphincter worked reported that they would have the device placed again, and about 96% of patients would recommend it to a friend in studies that were conducted after the device was performed. So in summary, incontinence can be treated. We have several effective treatment options. My recommendation is to seek out a healthcare professional who is well-versed in all these options and who is really interested in treating this. Sometimes we find that some physicians get too busy with the sort of bread and butter of urology to be concerned with all the details of treating incontinence after prostate cancer surgery. But there are many physicians, especially with cancer care specialists, who are trained to do that for you. There's no need to live with incontinence. It can be treated, and the treatments are good and effective. And with that, Carolyn, I'd like to turn over the presentation to you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Eid. Just a wonderful presentation, very informative, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And we now have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask our Stephanie to actually explain to everybody how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible, and if we would bring all the speakers on board as well for the Q&A. And if we don't get to your question, please do call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. And I'll repeat that again at the end of the call. But let's see how many questions we can take right now. Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Mr. Emil S. Your line is open.
Yeah, I've been doing Kegel exercises every morning for the last 4.5 years since my prostatectomy. I also wear pads and depends when I go out. But occasionally I still have a leakage problem. And I don't know what else to do. I'm on Vesicare. The problem with Vesicare is you got to drink it with 8 ounces of water at night. I have a problem where at night lying down, I seem to produce more urine than during the day. Are there any other things that I could do to alleviate this situation?
Well, Emil, thank you. That's really an excellent question. Dr. Eid, would you address that to start?
Yes, I think you're doing very well with coping with that. I think one option to consider at this point is the sling. I think the sling may be helpful for that. I don't know if you've considered that at all, or if you're I know you're trying to No one wants to have another procedure, but it's a relatively minor procedure. There are no device to activate or deactivate each time you want to urinate. So it sounds like the incontinence is well managed. It's a moderate to small amount of urine is leaking, and I think a sling may do the job.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question?
Again, to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone.
And we have a question from one of our online participants, Ashley. My father was recently diagnosed with prostate cancer but lives in another state. How can I help while being so far away? Bill, would you address that question?
That's a very important question, because I know in this day and age, especially with families being separated because of jobs and because of other familial situations and opportunities, that long-distance caregiving sort of becomes part and parcel of really providing care. And I think there are a number of national caregiving organizations, and that can be found in the literature that Dr. Messner has sent around. But there are also cancer-specific and prostate cancer-specific organizations that can direct a person to local organizations that may be able to provide some support, some advice, some suggestions as to how to create a local support structure for that person. In terms of home visits, in terms of volunteer visits, being in touch with, and also for the long-distance caregiver, you know, making sure that you have permission with release forms to be able to speak with the doctor, to speak with the oncologist, the pain management specialist, the social worker, so that you can really be in the loop in terms of providing the kind of care that you would like to provide were you living in the same area. I also think that, again, getting support for yourself and talking to other long-distance caregivers to figure out how to do this. It does become more complex when you're a long-distance caregiver, because you're not there, you're not seeing things, you're not here. You know, you're hearing things, but you're not in the room with the person. So it does create another obstacle. But you know, it is an obstacle that can be surmounted with proper support. So, what I would say, reach out to national caregiver organizations, talk to cancer-specific organizations like the Prostate Cancer Foundation, us too, and talk to other caregivers on how they do that.
This is Dr. Slovin. I just wanted to add one thing to Bill's excellent overview, and that is that very often there are multiple siblings that call or distant relatives, and it gets very, very difficult sometimes to be able to address everyone's questions, and sometimes family members just don't talk to other family members. So I always encourage people to identify one person and maybe another person after that one that could be the standby if necessary, so that only one person is really the liaison, as opposed to having multiple stories pass. Bill, do you want to comment on that perhaps?
I think that's an excellent point, Dr. Slovin, and I'm really glad you said that. And yes, there are oftentimes, I think it's really essential for the family to first create their own structure of support, to find out who's going to be the spokesperson for the family, for the person with cancer. If the person with cancer does not or should not be the spokesperson, pick out someone who has that ability, who really has the capacity to engage with the oncologist or with the pain management specialist. Everyone is busy. Doctors are busy. I mean, everyone has very full lives. So that person can be the conduit and sort of the middle person who can either speak with the doctor and then share that information with the person with cancer and the other family members, so that everyone is in the same loop. And this is really what provides organization within the family, is that one person becomes the central the foundation for the family, so that the information, the come and go and information can be shared, it can be clear, and that there's not misunderstanding or miscommunication. It's really, really essential in caregiving.
Oh, excellent. Excellent question and wonderful answers. Thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Christine L. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. My question is, I think, for Dr. Slovin about abiraterone. My husband's been on various drugs. He's had his cancer for 7 years now, and he was on nilutamide. It only worked for a couple of months. He's going to be starting abiraterone, and the doctor told us he'd be receiving it with a steroid. He's concerned about side effects. Can you tell me a little bit about what kind of side effects we should expect and if there's anything we can do to help him?
Absolutely. I think it's a perfectly excellent drug, very good efficacy, and very, very safe. The rationale for the steroids, which is really prednisone, it's 5 milligrams twice a day with food, so you take 5 in the morning with breakfast and 5 milligrams with dinner, is because it helps the adrenal, prevents the adrenal gland, which is being really targeted by this drug, from becoming, causing some sort of immunodeficiency, making people more tired, making them just not feel right. So it's important. It also prevents, keeps the electrolytes stable, such as the potassium and the magnesium, for example. Anyway, the overall side effects are nil. I don't remember the last time I really saw anybody with side effects. I will be very honest and tell you that Zytiga or abiraterone itself can have some fatigue, which is why the steroids are on board. This is really a physiologic dose of steroids, meaning it's not something that's going to cause somebody to get a moon face and a hump in their back. It really is a very small dose that is very well tolerated. If a person is a borderline diabetic or has diabetes, it is really a negligible rise in the sugar. It's nothing that would require that you see your diabetologist and have, you know, insulin on board or anything like that. It's actually very well tolerated. Other issues with prednisone, really not a whole heck of a lot. I mean, that's basically it. You know, at very high doses, it can cause a little bit of skin changes like acne. Prednisone will thin the skin a little bit, which means as people get older, you may have already noticed that you can see the veins more prominently in the hand or wherever else. And the reason for that is because the fat, as we get older, is lost under the skin, and all you got to do is whack your hand and it turns a little bit purple. Well, prednisone also thins the skin a little bit, so you might find a little bit more of these violet-colored little areas on your skin known as purpura. If they're benign, they won't hurt you, and they will get better over time. It's just a matter of the skin, the little capillaries under the skin not being as protected as much. But that's basically it.
Well, excellent. Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been outstanding. This has been an amazing call, and I hope all of the participants who asked questions also were helped with the answers that they received. And I want to thank all of you for participating today. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program and that we know that you have many needs that go far beyond 1 hour. And so I do want to remind all of you that although this workshop will soon be ending, that the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those will continue rather endlessly. And they include many different services, and they're all free. And they're provided by oncology social workers. They're trained social workers. And they offer someone to talk to, a counseling service, an individual basis or family or couple or group. And we also have group counseling, both on the telephone and online. And we offer as well these workshops and various publications and fact sheets and a very robust website with lots of information. So we would encourage you to take advantage of these services. We also do offer practical and financial assistance, which is often very helpful to people in coping, in coping with cancer. So I want you to I don't want anyone, as we conclude the program today, I don't want you to think that you're alone in coping with prostate cancer or cancer or in thinking about participating in the clinical trial. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support here. We do have support groups for caregivers. We have individual chances to talk with someone and lots of resources to connect you up with. So please take advantage of our services, and I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.